Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Stephen Jones, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thank you for joining us. Who would have thought the last time we were together that the name Ange Capuazzo would be ringing right through the rugby world? Nobody, but it is today. I'm Stephen Jones. We have with us today Alan Dimmock and Sam Warburton. Last time Sam was on, people in their hundreds wrote to say how good he was. Not a single person said anything about you or me, Al.
Yeah, well, it's typical. Story of a lifetime, isn't it?
Well, he's not. Well, still not won a journalistic award I know of. But no one wrote it at all. But everyone was all over him. It's bloody terrible, honestly. We just played a few against the Lions. Anyway, brief thoughts on the weekend. Hi, Sam. Well, welcome, mate. And just a brief thought from both of you lads about the weekend. Sam, climax of the Six Nations. It was all happening.
It didn't disappoint again, the Six Nations, from an entertainment value. I think it's great and romantic that France went at home with a winning try from Dupont, you know, so that was very fitting and thoroughly deserved. Ireland finished strong. Scotland, I think, showed their inconsistencies again, really. They can peak for a really big emotional performance, but just that consistency is lacking. And Wales have probably had their most humbling day in 15 years and darkest day in 15 years. So plenty going on to talk about, but a great entertaining day.
Some people say a dark day, but if you're, and I apologise for this, Sam, but if you're not Welsh, what a phenomenal result that was on Saturday morning. Now, as you can imagine, as the Scot in the room, I'm going to choose to ignore the game in the middle, but to see the Italians get the monkey off the back for the first time in 7 years, but not only that, to do it in such thrilling, breathtaking fashion at the end with the emergence of a new star that Steve mentioned right at the top. I mean, for the neutrals out there, and particularly for the Italians, what a phenomenal moment. I remember doing a piece recently with the guys who were in the last time Italy won a Six Nations match, and bless them, I can't blame them for this. Few of them could remember a lot of the details because it was so long ago. So yeah, to have this now, fair play, and it just teed up what was an excellent day of rugby.
We'll come to that. My memory is not of the weekend. It's of Saturday night, in or rather early Sunday morning, when Eddie Jones was asked what any message for England followers, and he said, "They've got to be patient, mate." Well, mate, they've been patient for long enough as far as I'm concerned, mate. And somewhere, mate, we need a new coach, mate. Or England need a new coach. That's my opinion. So we'll see what happens to that. Coming up on this week's podcast, we'll look back on all the action, including wins for France, Ireland and Italy. We'll discuss France's historic Grand Slam. And also, we've got something really worth listening to, or even more worth listening to than us three, and that's France's head of performance, Thibaut Giroud, will join us to explain how he has transformed this French team. And really, I do mean transformed it. Then we'll pick our God and Goddess of the Week. First, Sam, can we start with the Grand Slam winners? They threatened to win it all the way through. People now and again think, well, you can upset France, but no one did. And worthy Grand Slam winners for you?
Yeah, definitely worthy Grand Slam winners, I thought and predicted. You know, when we sat down together a while ago, when we wrote our columns, who we thought was going to win, I thought it would be a French Grand Slam. And you know, and they've been building quietly and nicely for the past few years as well. It's not like a championship out of the blue. Say like Wales won 1 in 5 games in 2020, then they won the championship the year after, back to only winning 1 in 5 this year round. But France has been consistently good now for 3 years. They've been knocking on the door for a while. Thoroughly deserve it. And I think the biggest thing we've learned, and that coaches will pick up from this campaign as well, is that the importance of having power athletes in your pack who can handle and having backs who have as much emphasis at defensive breakdown as the forwards. And because they got that across the board, from 1 to 15, they defend like crazy at the breakdown and take immense pride in that. And similarly, they've got players from 1 to 15 who are comfortable handling and carrying with a great level of power to it as well. That's why, and Ireland are close to that, you know, they're very close. That's why those two teams are separated from everyone else. So, yeah, definitely worthy winners, and they've moved on when the other home nations haven't.
I'd actually go a step further than Sam here and say that those two teams, as well as being a little bit of a distance ahead, they're also very aware of who they are in terms of the style of play that they want. Now, France and Ireland actually play a very different style of rugby. Ireland are all about volume and hitting things and building pressure, whereas France are happy to punt the ball away and say, you have it for a while. It's all about efficiency with them. Now, the red zone efficiency might not quite be as good as Ireland at the moment, but when I say efficiency, I mean across the park. You know, they're about those little victories here, there and everywhere. And it was noticeable this game against England that France's ruck speed efficiency, France's red zone efficiency against England was 4.4. So compared to England's 0.88. That's from Ross Hamilton, the analyst, friend of the podcast. And what that tells us is that when France wanted to go for it, they were ruthlessly efficient. And against England, guess how much time they spent in England's 22? 46 seconds. And they came away with all those points because they just know who they are. They go, do we need to get some points here? Great. If we don't want the ball. You have it. And it's just, I think there's a lot of other teams out there that would be delighted to say, we know exactly who we are. We know exactly what style we play. And in any given opportunity, that is our identity.
So, Sam, didn't they lack of anything? They didn't actually have what you might call a Sam Warburton or a Richie McCaw in their team, do they? How do they get around that, not having a real specialist seven?
They have, because everybody just contributes. Like, yeah. So, you know, when I played, and still sevens now, you might have, I remember a good game, I'd probably compete at 15 to 18 rucks, you know? But when the game is, say now, might be 100-odd, 130 rucks, you know, that means I can only influence one in six rucks. So, like, you know, it needs to be a skill set across the team. So because Fiku will dip in and do it, Dante will dip in and do it, Marchand will dip in and compete. Obviously, Aldrich competes. DuPont will compete 3, 4, 5 times. Because they do it across the board, and I reckon they compete at 90% of rucks. That's something Sean does. He wants to cause havoc at every ruck. So the moment England only have ball carrier plus one, which happened on a lot of occasions. They ran out of system, they ran out of shape. Well, because there's a good threat there, then they pounce and get the ball because they're relentless at competing. So I think that's something that a lot of defence coaches can learn. It's making sure you don't just hang your hat on one or two players who can compete for you. I think the game's moving now, and particularly with the jackler not move, the ball carrier not being able to move on the floor, not being able to have that second role on the floor, has really brought the jackler back into play. And I remember when the law change came in, no movement on the floor, I watched the first game in the Southern Hemisphere somewhere. And I remember texting an analyst who was working with Wales at the time. I just went, the jackler's back. So if they want to try and reduce the effectiveness of the jackler, we're all talking about how the 50-22 has been a great rule, which it has. But if you want to actually promote free flow in rugby, which World Rugby want to do, I would actually bring back in the role if their priority is more attack in rugby, because I think not being able to move on the floor makes it so much easier for the jacklers to compete. And we're seeing more backs than ever compete over the ball. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that jackler doesn't move, the ball carrier doesn't move anymore on the floor to change the picture. So, but I mean, I enjoy it. If I was playing, I'd be loving it because the ball's there on a plate for you. And if you win the race there, you get the ball. But
And Gregory Audrey is making a lot of hay there at the moment, isn't he?
Oh, big time. I mean, he's so good there. But imagine if you watch a lot of those examples and the ball carrier is allowed to wriggle forward another 1 meter or have a 360 roll, or, you know, like kind of do that double present where you can present and spin and present again. That buys an extra 1 second for your support players, which is massive. So if World Rugby are enjoying what they're seeing and the defence is having a bit more dominance than before, it makes it much harder for attack, and keep the rule. But if you want attack and rugby to be a priority, then I would actually bring back the second movement on the floor.
Okay, well, it's very interesting, lads. this stage, we're going to go on to Thibaut Giroux, who's the head of French performance, and basically to tell us where this French team came from.
Lucky enough to be joined here by Thibaut Giroux, the head of performance for the French national team. Thibaut, is the party still going on in Paris?
Well, I'm sure there's some guys still on it. We stayed all together after the game. Obviously, we had like a big party with the families and then sponsors and then all the players and coaches and stuff. And then some of the guys went for another meal. A lunch on a Sunday, and then a lot of the guys left, coaches and stuff, Sunday night. But I'm pretty sure some of the guys stayed in, and then they're all sleeping now.
And who can blame them? Thibaut, sure. Obviously, it all culminated with a massive win at home on Saturday night, the end Super Saturday Grand Slam, first one for 12 years. But I was wondering if you could take us right back to when you first came in and when Galtier first started making his plans. What was the big message? What did you guys want to change with this France setup and the style that you played and the type of athletes that you had to get to this point?
Well, I think one of the massive key point for us was to get involved for the Japan World Cup in 2019. So Fabien Galtier called me up. I was at Toulon at the time, and then I was coaching Toulon, and then so the French team called me up to take over as the same role as I have now for the World Cup in Japan. So Fabien came, I came, and Laurent Labitte, the attack coach, came. So to be part of the staff from the previous head coach. So I think for us was like massive buying time, because we got there. I planned everything for the World Cup, you know, for the preparation and everything. And then for us that was massive to get involved there, because we actually realized what we had to do and then you know where the French team was the last 10 years, and I think that would have been much different if we came later, like after the World Cup in November when the other coaching staff came in. So yeah, for us, I think if there's one massive key thing for us is to be involved with the 2019 World Cup. That's where we realized that we had to change everything: the performance size, the culture, the way of playing, how we train, because France had like a massive culture of not training too much, pretty much, or maybe training very general. So you know, we had to change everything, and then when we had to make a statement that if you want to be part of that team, then that's where you have to be. So that was for us massive. That's why we made the decision to go very aggressive on the World Cup preparation. We lost around 15 players through injury, but we had to go through that revolution. Other nations, other teams did that previously, but we had to do it. Otherwise, that was not just to take everybody to World Cup and just to be nice with people. We had to be very aggressive, and then we were attacked by media, clubs, players back in that time, because obviously the level of performance or level of training, the intensity that we put in, you know, they were not used to that. So obviously some of the boys were not ready for that. They were too big or too slow or not used to get that kind of training. So we were like, we had like a lot of criticizing during that time, but we just kept going. And then because we knew that we had to get ready for after that World Cup. So yeah, for me and then for us, the key point was that 2019 World Cup.
Okay. Now, I've spoken to you and you've spoken to other people about the job that you had on getting this front five in particular to be as efficient as possible. I was just wondering if you could explain to us the job that you guys have done with the front five forwards that, in this playing group that you've got, and what you've done with them to get them up to the level where they're playing some pretty frightening rugby now.
Yeah, well, you know, France always been, because we don't speak the same language, because rugby's been, you know, all the decision, all the science, everything, you know, is pretty much Anglo-Saxon things. And then we, the, one of the only country not speaking English. And then we have the tendency of looking at, you know, at ourselves and not maybe looking at what's going on outside. So, you know, one of the main thing when we came is to, you know, look at where we were and then what was the best out there, you know, either England or All Blacks or South Africa or all the big teams. And then so we compare to them, you know, all, you know, everything on the performance side or rugby or what kind of athlete we had and what the players were able to do and what the other were able to do. So the first job we had, in especially in my side, in my field, is to compare with everybody else to see where we stand. And then we realized we were far away from everything, especially in the performance side, and then especially in the front five. I have to say the front eight, the boys were too big, too slow, couldn't keep up, couldn't play high-intensity rugby. It's either they were good into contact intensity or they were good in running intensity, but they couldn't combine both. They were slow off the ground, they were slow reloading offensively, they were slow line speed defensively. You know, to combine the high intensity running and the high intensity combat, you know, was a main thing. So it's like, you know, you have two rocks. You have a rock who weigh 20 kg, and then you have a rock who weigh 10 kg, and then you throw the rock against the wall, the two rocks against the wall. Most of the people thought that's the 20 kg rock who's gonna make some more damage, but it's not. It's a 10 kg rock because you can produce more acceleration.
Thibaut, is that Gavin Villiers? Is he the 10 kg rock?
Yeah, well, I'm talking more about the front fives. That's why we asked him to lose a lot of weight. You know, like Paul Williams, yeah, he couldn't make the World Cup prep. He lost about 12 kg. The second one lost about 10. Bernard Leroux same, lost about 10. The props, I mean, they all did a great job because they bought into what we try to do. And then they, you know, they did what we asked, and also the clubs, the top 14 clubs, helped us a lot because they were behind us and then understood what we try to do and then bought into it. So that's a collective work.
Can I ask you a question about you're talking about a big transformation from sheer weight to power and pace, etc. And you're talking about sort of changing the whole culture of French rugby, etc., which you've successfully done. But did you expect, while this process was ongoing, that you would continue to win your matches? Because sometimes when you change the culture, you maybe have one or two bad seasons until it becomes ingrained, but you've just won the Grand Slam.
Yeah, no, I know, but we, you know, we had to do our revolution. That's what I said. We, like I said, we took the Japan World Cup, you know, as a laboratory to put our system in place. And then, and after the World Cup, we changed a lot of the players because a lot of the players were at the end of their career. So we decided to go for young players that we can format, and then we can actually build, and then we can actually, transfer all the quality that we wanted for the game plan to those young players. So that was the main thing. And then the message was sent after the World Cup that if you want to come to the French team, then you have to be in top shape, and then you cannot be overweight, you cannot be not out of shape in terms of general preparation. So when they come to camp after the World Cup, they knew that they had to be ready, and then they knew that they had to do a lot of work in the performance side, because we will not accept players who you have to develop general things. You know, that's the club job. That's where they're in the club. When they come to national team, if they don't have the specific attribute, you know, a specific target that we wanted for the performance, then we couldn't pick the boys. So they, because the preparation for the World Cup was so hard, for so tough for them, they knew that after the World Cup, you know, they knew they had to come up in top shape and then develop the specific target that we wanted. If not, then we'll pick someone else. But also we had the chance to have, you know, a great generation of young players too, you know, because like I said, you cannot make a dolphin a shark, you know. So you know, we're very lucky that we have that generation with us now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Guys, at the Stade de France on Saturday evening, or Saturday night almost, I thought it was probably the most amazing atmosphere I'd ever experienced. The singing of the anthem was up there with the Welsh National Anthem in Cardiff, and probably as loud as anything I've ever heard. The tension was massive. I just wonder, guys, early on, France blew a couple of tries, and never didn't put England away maybe as much as they should. Were there some nerves at play there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this question was put to me before about will France be nervous for the Grand Slam game, even though they've shown so much dominance? Oh my goodness, of course, because this is the moment which they would have stumbled on a couple of times before. Not a definitive Grand Slam game, but the two championships gone by, they've fallen at hurdles. And this is the time they needed to prove to themselves they can deliver when the pressure is on. And you know that that's what you get judged on. If they lost that game, even though France has been so good in the autumn and for the first four games of the championship, the pressure and the scrutiny would have been enormous, would have been massive for them if they lost that game. So I thought it was great that you're going to make mistakes in the game. That's fine. But I thought it was great that they, and like Alan says, I think it's absolutely right. They know who they are. Mm. They stick to their game plan. And they came out on top. They just kept that trust and faith in what they're about and thoroughly deserved winners. And I was the same at on the telly. I was watching it. And my wife tried talking to me at one point. I said, hang on, quiet. Because it was the anthems. And I wanted to hear the French anthem. And I got it from the telly. You could tell that place was rocking. And because they haven't had success for 12 years, they're desperate to see it. And I'm actually really pleased that France, the superpower that I grew up watching, are back. And I think they're going to be around for a while as well.
And the interesting thing is that whilst Six Nations time every year, we've got people desperately scrambling to be seen as an underdog of some kind. We had Gregory Aldrete on this very podcast before the Six Nations started, and he said, it's time to deliver. We've finished second for 2 years in a row. It's time to finally deliver. They're not scared of being front runners. Everyone talks about it's World Cup, World Cup, World Cup. We're at the Six Nations before it's World Cup year, and they wanted to perform. They wanted to achieve something. They wanted to be a front runner. And it's important to look at the concepts of this. Yes, they're hosting the Rugby World Cup next year. Yes, there's then an Olympics after that. They're the current football world champions, and over 10 million people tuned in to watch a passionate French side perform incredibly well and deliver what they said they were going to deliver. And I just think it's great for the context of the global game. We need a moment like this, I think. It's given everyone a shot in the arm. And as we'll go on to talk about, coaches and players and pundits alike from all over the world now are scrambling. How can we keep up with France?
Okay, well, there was another team out there, allegedly. We're going to hear from Eddie Jones.
Yeah, I think I've done a reasonable job for England over the past 7 years. We're going through a period now where we're rebuilding the team. And it takes time, mate. You know, look at the French team. It took them 3 years to win the championship. You know, we've rebuilt the side from the last Six Nations. I think the progress is very positive. The results aren't the results that we'd like. We'd all like to be winning tournaments and all like to be at the top of the table, but we're not quite good enough to do that now. But within the next 12 to 14 months, where we prepare for the World Cup, we will be.
Okay, that was Eddie. One or two people didn't agree. The heading in the Thunderer this morning, with Owen Slot's byline, England deserve better. Huge headline with a picture of Eddie. And in the Daily Mail, a little-known paper, but apparently it's still going, Eddie's neck should be on the block. So no patience there, really. I have to say I agree totally with that. I think that Eddie's in reverse. The chaos regarding the way they're trying to play and the selection is just utterly chaotic. I think Eddie knows it. And the idea that, as we now know, the RFU have come out to say they fully support Eddie Jones is unbelievable, because they, at the same time, they're announcing an investigation into what's gone right or what's gone wrong. So how can you fully support the coach when you're introducing an investigation into him, Al?
Yeah, it's an interesting time. It's, I suppose, the cynic in you could say, well, Eddie Jones wields so much power within the RFU. It's been his baby for two Rugby World Cup cycles. Rugby World Cup is the be-all and end-all because we keep hearing about that, so Six Nations can go hang. And, you know, he's beaten the world champions, and I'm imagining it would be quite a lot of money to wave bye-bye. So you add all these things into the pot. It seems that it was always quite unlikely that Eddie Jones was going to go. I think what a lot of fans will find galling is the chat of the style of play. I just want to read out some numbers from you from this Six Nations. England were outscored 2-1 versus Scotland, 3-1 versus Wales, 4-0 versus Ireland, and 3-1 versus 5. They are fifth in the table for red zone efficiency, as in when they get into the opposition 22, only Italy were worse than them this Six Nations. So that's the progress that we're being told is on. The question is do you want to shake things up this close to what we're told is the Holy Grail? Now, there's two sides to that coin. So South Africa in 2018 made a change around about this time to get rid of Alistair Coetzee and bring in Razzie Erasmus. Australia got rid of Ewan McKenzie the World Cup cycle before and brought in Cheka. The Pumas have just got rid of their head coach, and Michael Cheka's back again around about this time. So change is possible. On the other side of that coin, though, is in the case of Australia and South Africa, you can make a massive transformation this time out from a Rugby World Cup and really turn things around and turn it into a good team. But those were with coaching changes. The question, I suppose, is can the same person make that massive monumental change from now till then?
Well, he's made the massive monumental cock-up, so I presume he couldn't, otherwise he wouldn't have done it in the first place.
Well, yeah, that's the big question, isn't it?
Sam, what's your views? You've been watching England, obviously, clearly closely in your capacity as summariser and commentator. What's your view? Are we over the top, or are they struggling?
I can imagine I could have a very strong view and say Eddie's got to go. But then, and this is where I would be completely humbled, he'd say, hang on a second, I've coached England to 3 Six Nations titles and taken two teams to a World Cup final. What have you done? So you go, okay, fair enough. So then I said, you think, well, who am I to say whether he's good to go or not? But then when you hear the facts, say what Alan just said, and like, we're talking about England now. Like, no, we're not talking about Wales or Scotland or Italy, who have been inconsistent, you know, over the last couple of decades. You know, we're talking England. Like, they got to be a superpower. It's disrespectful to England to say they're progressing, to England fans to say they're progressing with 2-5. That's not where England are at. That's not England, you know. They're like, they're one of the superpowers of world rugby. So it's, for me, it's just this whole World Cup thing. One, is disrespectful to the Six Nations. Two, it's just buying yourself more time, because the Six Nations is hugely important, massively important. And yeah, I just think if England came out and said, we're really disappointed, England have under-delivered this campaign, but we're going to stick with Eddie Jones for the next 18 months. He's our guy to the World Cup. Then we will review. I think that at least that's a more honest assessment. But to say that they're pleased with progress is very dishonest, I think. And if it is, then there's a significant problem in the hierarchy of the RFU if they think that's acceptable from a leadership standpoint. So I just think, you know, from from an ambition, like that's just not right. You shouldn't be speaking on behalf of England if that's your mindset, because you're in the wrong place. So I think it's very a dishonest statement.
Sam, when you were captain, would you and Warren have got hold of, I'm talking about the specific play, one of the specific plays that France used, that England used on Saturday night, would you have told Adam Jones to stick 60 yards back by the fullback and catch every long kick and beast it up 50 yards into the defence?
I'd like to have seen it.
Well, they did it in the autumn with Manu Tuilagi, didn't they? They put Manu at wing, and he used to stand inside the fullback, and then he'd charge it up. So Genge was just being asked to replace the role of Manu Tuilagi, but then you've got to go and ask him to scrimmage and maul and like, oh, Alan, like, oh, you know, that the workload on front five is enormous in the pro game now, you know, and to do that as well, I think is a massive ask. And Genge, by the way, has been fantastic for England. I think he's really developed into a top-class player and leader for them. But it, like, and say what Alan said on Ireland and France, they know their team. England and Wales clearly don't know their best 15. They really don't know what their best 15 is, and that's a significant problem. You can see it with the number of changes they made. I think France made only 5 changes. England and Wales made something like 15 to 18 changes. Ireland made a lot, but that's because they do that at Leinster. They got a very good system where they can drop players in and out, and some are injury enforced, and they're in a position where they can rotate because they're doing well. But England and Wales, it's just a reflection of how they do not know their best 15. And I do think England have sorely missed Curry and Underhill together. I know Underhill's been injured and been coming back and hasn't hit the heights that he needs to, but England need to physically dominate to be where they need to be. And I think they've really missed Curry the last few games. They've missed Underhill not being on top form in this past 12 months since coming back from injury. You know, Watson's a big miss. May's a big miss. I think Farrell's been a massive miss from a game management and leadership perspective as well. So I think there are some key players to come back. I do believe that. But then again, this is England. We shouldn't be they shouldn't be hanging their hats on 5 players.
Yeah, and that's a great point that Sam makes about Underhill and Curry and Watson and Farrell is the big. It's very clear the absence of Owen Farrell from this side. And actually on selection, it's to throw in the curveball of going, we're going to drop Max Malins, who's played all Six Nations, to bring in Furbank. Is Furbank going to be such a question mark that France are going to be bamboozled into not knowing what to do with him? It comes down to that identity thing, because England can hammer away in France's 22, and they spent over 7 minutes in there to try and get a little change out of the game whatsoever. But it's when you look at the style of play that there was in that second half and you go, right, was the tactic to put up NRL-style fifth tackle high balls into France's 22 and hope that they cough up enough of a mistake so that we can outscore them in tries? Fascinating tactic. Didn't quite work out. I'm going to, I'm going to have to be the one that plays devil's advocate here and say there are huge plus points in if you use Freddie Stewart properly. And if you use Joe Marchand in the vein that he's in at the moment, those guys have got a phenomenal upside. They've had very good Six Nations, and it'll be fascinating to see how those guys go. It's just this: what style of play you want that England team to be playing? Because, you know, if Youngs is coming in and out, are we going to stick with Harry Randall? It's just fascinating. And I suppose one of the things you can say is you can afford to have question marks about this now. Next Six Nations, I don't know.
I still say he should go. We now move on to the other games. I know we all feel conflicted, or maybe Welsh fans feel conflicted, Sam, but we were despairing of Italy. 36 games losing. No doubt when you were captain, you would have hated to be the one who eventually lost to them, but there was a certain uplifting quality about it, wasn't there, even for Welsh fans?
Well, obviously, I'm Welsh, right, through and through. And from a Welsh perspective, yeah, of course, we lost. I'm gutted. But I was actually, I can emotionally detach myself when I'm covering the game, because I kind of want what's best for rugby and for people to love rugby. And in a very strange way, I was, hopefully it wasn't going to be at Wales' expense, which it was, but I was pleased that Italy won in the fashion they won, and hopefully unearthing a gem and a new poster boy beyond Parise, who can, of course, a team needs to be built on more than one person, but a team needs a catalyst. And I'm hoping this is going to be the catalyst for Italy. Then it's backed up with Treviso's efforts in the URC last year, and then it's backed up by the under-20s, I think winning three games in the championship this year. Then suddenly you're looking forward and you're like, okay, well, yeah, let's keep the faith. Let's keep building. I still think there should be relegation, a playoff rather. And that's not to scapegoat Italy or anyone. And listen, if I had Wales's best interest, I would not be suggesting this, you know, with one win in five. I'm saying it because I think it would be great entertainment. Imagine that Wales-Italy game that just happened. Imagine Wales were a bonus point short of what they were, or a couple of bonus points short. Suddenly that Capuzzo line break and Padovani try could be one of the single greatest, most controversial moments ever in Six Nations history, which plummet Wales into a playoff game. You know, I just think the opportunity that could be there, and obviously it would really help, it would really invigorate the teams in Tier 2, which might take another 10 years to get to that standard. But just to have that opportunity, I think, and that drama would be amazing. But yeah, I think embarrassing is a strong word, but if I'm being honest, it's embarrassing losing at home to Italy because, you know, you, as a player, as a team, you always aspire to be one of the best in the world. And you know, would that happen to New Zealand at home? Would that happen to South Africa at home? It wouldn't happen to England at home. Mm. You don't. It's inexcusable, I think, to lose to Italy at home. It really is. And you know, Italy haven't been like knocking on the door, by the way, in the last four games. They've been beaten well, 20-odd, 30 points a game, and then to go to Wales and win, I just think I'm actually baffled in how they did it with Wales. You know, it is a dark day for Welsh rugby.
Sam, obviously, when these occasions, the coach out thing starts. It's well in train in Edinburgh. In England. We'll ask Al whether it's in training in Murrayfield as well, but. Wayne Pivac's going to be under pressure. I mean, would I be wrong in thinking it's slightly premature to start talking about getting rid of him? Has he been that bad?
You know, Eddie Jones has got a lot more credit in the bank because obviously he's got three titles under his belt and a World Cup. So, you know, I think England will. They've said it, but I thought before the statement, they definitely stick with Eddie. You know, they will. They're not going to. I think they would perceive it's quite football-esque to just to give him the shepherd's hook now, which would be sort of very Premiership football kind of standards. The thing with Pivac is like the only people will know are the people on the inside. Like there could be all sorts of reasons why Team Wales lost a game. They could have had a terrible. I'm not saying this is the case. They could have had a terrible training week where they did way too much volume. In which case, that's the fitness coach's staff. You know, were the players ill? Were they given the complete wrong tactics from coaches, which makes it the coach issue? Is it that Wales have been relying on the sort of senior players for too long? We haven't harnessed the younger players. And I think there's much deeper issues in Wales than just losing a game. I think it'd be superficial just to look at, at Wyn Jones, disallowed try. It's getting to the point now with the national team have papered over cracks for a long, long time. And you know, Steve, as much as anyone else listening, that the reasons in WIU are not aligned in any shape or form. And we don't have the large player pool to pluck out from 12 teams like France and England. And we have to harness everything we have with a magnifying glass, with extreme accuracy and scrutiny, because we only have 150 pro players to pick from, maybe less than that if you count the foreign guys in the regions. 120 pro players to pick from. We can't let anyone fall through the fishnet. We've got some good young athletes who need time put into them throughout the whole season from the national coaches, and they can't just dip in and out of campaigns. You know, they've got to be supervised, monitored, progressed all year round. And the regions in W have got to be streamlined. At the minute, they're not. It's, you know, regions don't have faith in the union and the union don't have faith in the regions, you know, and it needs to somehow be aligned. It's going to take a lot of heads to get to bang them together and come out with the right solution. But if things are carrying on like they are, I cannot see much change.
Very well said.
Yeah, and there's no public discussion like the Welsh rugby public discussion about the state of the union. And you know, it will go on for a while. We'll hear a lot of voices on this. There'll be a lot of different views. I just want to bring it back to this game and how important it is for Italy, and actually to not gloss over some of the aspects of Italy's play that were so special. And, you know, we're going to be talking about Ange Capuazzo a lot in the coming year, I suppose. He's secured himself a big move to Toulouse. He scored a couple tries against Scotland. He's put on a match winner for Edo Padovani against Wales. His future is very bright. But Danilo Fischetti, the loose head for Italy, deserves enormous credit. What a nuisance he was that entire game. That was the game of his life. Michele Lamaro, the skipper, deserves huge credit for that match. And Garbisi for just chipping over the winner and giving us that moment of elation at the end. You know, these guys, it's a heroic effort. Because, let's be honest, we don't know when we'll see it again. Hopefully, maybe things are starting to turn around and we'll see change. But I just think we need to give those guys the big banner moment.
It's just quickly going to Scotland, because, fair play, Wales may have lost, but at least they weren't on the piss like Scotland. So where would you say that leaves Scotland's drinking capacity now and their team?
I think the drinking capacity has probably never been in question.
Okay.
it's interesting listening to the storm grow and grow, and actually the way of things in the modern world now is sometimes stories break organically via WhatsApp, and there were voice notes doing the round explaining what had happened with Scotland, and obviously the veracity of those would need to be questioned. But the clear thing that came out of this is that there was an issue, it was handled internally, everyone hoped that that would be swept under the carpet and that they could focus on the, here comes the buzzwords, a really good training week in preparation for the test match. And however good that training week was, it didn't help, because Scotland were completely humbled by Ireland in Dublin. It's an absolute stinker of a down note for Scotland and the Six Nations, where there was a lot of ambition, and I think Sam even wrote in his column before the Six Nations that Scotland had a really good chance. And in the end, what a damp squib it's been. Now, Steve wants to talk about the trains rolling for the chat of coaches coming or going. I think for all these cases we're talking about, it's the point of no return now. So you decide to stick with someone or you don't. You need to make that decision now, because you can't make it in 4 months' time. So afterwards the game, it was put to Gregor Townsend, and he definitively said that he thought that he was going nowhere. Which sounds like he must.
That could take that both ways. I'm going nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. But so it's, he must have a hell of a lot of say. But the thing with the SRU is that there are two very, very powerful people in the building. It's him and Mark Dodson. So if they don't fancy change ain't happening. But something needs to change. And there were a lot of grumpy players from that Scotland team afterwards. And however much they try and say, oh, you guys are being negative, there's a lot of reasons to be negative, because it was a horrible end to Six Nations for Scotland.
Guys, thanks very much for that. Absolutely fascinating insights there. After a magnificent weekend, however you look at it, maybe controversial, but always magnificent and great for the Six Nations. Just go on to God or Goddess. Al, we go on to yours first. Give Sam a little bit more thinking time. But
to be honest,
God or Goddess.
As much as I bigged up Danilo Fischetti, it's got to be Ange Capuazzo. I mean, France got the Grand Slam, fantastic, but little Italian wizard in only his second cap, his first ever start, pulled off a try winner, burnt past Josh Adams, who was gracious enough to try and give him his Man of the Match award afterwards. It's a name that hopefully we'll be hearing a lot more of.
Sam.
Yep, I agree, actually. I would like to try and be authentic and think of someone different, but I just think Italy have been desperately needing someone other, since Parise has left this enormous void. I think all of us who witnessed Saturday's game against Wales will never forget the impact of Capuazzo. And he obviously, he scored two tries a week before coming off the bench, you know. So I'm just really pleased that Italy have finally got a really high-profile new poster boy who can hopefully help lead this team, along with Garbisi and Fischetti, who are, you know, Garbisi's what, 22, Fischetti's 24, and suddenly it looks excited. So Capuazzo is going to be my God of the Week, and I'm really pleased that he's delivered for Italy, and hopefully is the catalyst for good things to come.
And I totally agree to make it 3-0, a rare blanket vote there. And also, as Sam said, the under-20s have in Italy have been not dominant, but certainly one of the better teams. So that's all good. Guys, Al, thank you very much for those for your input and those stats. Very, very good. I never had you down as a stato, but they were very good. Also, Sam, for all your columns and all your comments during the Six Nations, as ever, mate, wonderfully well, worth listening to and hearing. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be part of the team.
There's no women's roundup this week, everybody, because on Thursday we have a full women's Six Nations preview. Coming up on Thursday with myself, Jess Hayden, England's Sarah McKenna, and Siwan Lillycrap, the Welsh captain. So we look ahead to that on Thursday. Thanks for joining us today.